Good afternoon, everyone. Today is February 24th, and this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. And Senator Johnson is running late today. She asked me to handle the gavel. I know that Representative Witt is not feeling well, and I believe everybody else is going to be here soon. But we have a full agenda because, as I recall, we've got about 30 slides left to go with the Housing and Community Services Department, and then plus we have some additional business to take care of, plus public comment.
Yes, that is correct.
So anything to add, Ms. Deister?
Put your track shoes on.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and convene the public hearing on Senate Bill 5513. I think that we'll be able to keep questions to a minimum if you'd like to go ahead and jump right in.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Glad to be here to resume the agency presentation. I thought I would get started with answering a few of the questions that were posed yesterday. A few others, we want a little bit of time to provide answers in writing, and a couple of my partners who are here for public testimony will also be able to shed light on a couple of questions.
What do you think? Maybe we jump into some of the slides and come back to the questions to make sure that the people that asked them are here.
That makes more sense, doesn't it? Thank you, sir.
Okay,
so we are working on we were methodically going through the program areas and providing the high-level overview of the kind of budget figures that are in the governor's budget for 15-17. And so the final program area is bond-related funds. Again, the agency issues tax-exempt bonds to do a lot of the housing finance. Primarily, the biggest dollars are in multifamily, but we also use them for single family, for both new development and preservation of affordable rental housing. In this program area, you'll also see the proposal that's in the governor's budget for $85 million in general fund-backed bonds for new affordable housing construction. So several program-related recommendations came out of the transition work that the agency had done over the last couple of years, so I'll recap those. Probably the biggest one is one that we referenced briefly yesterday, and it has to do with recalibrating, if you will, our policy and governance model. House Bill 2442, which is working its way through the legislative process, would consolidate our governance bodies into an overarching Oregon Housing Stability Council. And what you can see here is that it would sunset and sort of end the service of a few of the existing bodies. Some of the duties of the existing bodies would be assumed by the Oregon Housing Stability Council, and some others would be jointly shared with the Community Action Partnership of Oregon and the Housing Stability Council. And so on the left are the bodies that would stay, if you will, and effectively on the right with the light gray colored slides are the ones that would cease to operate. And some of those duties, in particular the Advisory Committee on Energy and the homelessness and related bodies, their work would be assumed by the new Housing Stability Council. Other program area improvements that came out of our process were informed by what we called a scenario building process. We did a deep dive on data and service delivery models and financial information on most of our programs. A lot of what came out of that work is recommendations for changes that we can make in administrative rule, and we've been on the path to do that work. But some are actually need statutory change, and so Senate Bill 244 is also working its way through the process, and that is frankly fairly minor but still important program criteria alignment in statutory language. Those are that Senate Bill 244 is not controversial at all, and so we don't expect that folks will have a problem with that. And then along the way, we're continuing to do a lot of internal policy and procedure change just to support our staff to be really clear about what the rules are when they administer grants and so forth, and that process continues. As you heard yesterday, and you'll hear a little bit more about today, there is a recommendation to transfer responsibility for the food programs that are currently administered by my agency to transfer those next biennium to Department of Human Services. It's the Oregon Hunger Response Fund, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, Commodity Supplemental Food Program, and the Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations, which can be administered directly by the tribes. And so those are pieces that we're working on. I can report that we have staff from both DHS and my agency working together to sort of methodically go through the process of what will be required programmatically and from a just a grants administration point of view to make sure that we don't miss a beat in administering those important food programs. I think the other point I want to make about this is, and we touched on this yesterday, but I think it bears repeating, we very much see that the housing policy as a general matter can be better served if we sort of get savvy, if you will, about housing access and stabilization policy as an agency, and that we don't need to tool ourselves up to be savvy about food and security policy as well. We think that's better done by an agency that's more equipped to do that on a bigger scale. So those are our program recommendations. We talked yesterday about KPMs, and so here are the eight that I walked you through yesterday in the course of the program overviews. And again, I would underscore that I'm very committed to really driving towards more meaningful metrics, and that we think that those will we can do that well if we are further down the path in thinking about the intelligent use of data and research, and if we're informed by this new higher level Housing Stability Council. And so that's a piece we're going to work on, and I'm going to I'll come back to that in just a minute. This slide shows you what we were asked to do at the end of the last budget process in terms of the budget note. So we came, we said we're in transition, we had the one-year budget, we talked to the committee about this. Our budget had this note that asked us to come back and report on several things. And so this chart shows you what we were asked to do and sort of where we are in process on all those pieces. It's really the KPMs there towards the bottom that are in progress still. And again, I think I mentioned yesterday, I had been pretty hopeful and a little overly optimistic that I could bring back revised KPM recommendations, and we're just not ready to do that in a way that I think serves our long-term interests. So that's a piece we'll come back with. And then here's sort of our commitment again to think about doing that for the next biennium, driving towards really being smarter about grabbing data and research, being thoughtful as we partner more deeply with our sister agencies about where our interventions can be most impactful in other parts of kind of the safety net and human service world. So in terms of legislation for the agency, the kind of biggest thing outside of the governance and policy bill is the proposal for $100 million in new money for housing. We talked yesterday about the kind of the severe gap, if you will, in the availability of affordable rental housing for poor families. And so what the governor's budget proposes is that we target this new resource really to families with the lowest incomes to help prevent and end families' homelessness. The breakdown as proposed in the budget is $85 million in general fund backed bonds or Article 11Q bonds, and the other 15 would be lottery backed bonds. We've used lottery-backed bonds a number of times, the Article 11Q bonds we have not used for housing. And so I want to say very clearly that we're going to work very closely with bond counsel, both at the Oregon Department of Justice and outside expert bond counsel, to be sure that we carve a path to execute on this kind of a financing mechanism in a way that meets all the constitutional requirements. And from a policy perspective, we actually really want to get the advice of our partners on the ground and kind of experts in the field about how to target this resource very carefully. I'm imagining that as we go through the legislative process, our housing council and our partners will work closely with us to help give shape to sort of what are some of the priorities and how it is that we might execute on those new resources in the most thoughtful way possible. There's a lot of choices we're going to have to make, and so I certainly don't want to try and have the agency do that without the good advice of its partners. The other thing I want to stress here is that we see this as an opportunity to partner with other state agencies, particularly the Department of Human Services, and the director, Kelly Seal, and I are working on how can we think about her self-sufficiency kind of redesign in new directions in a way that leverages this money and vice versa. Similarly, in the child welfare world, we know that one of the big barriers for families who are in the child welfare system is the lack of stable housing. And if those families could have access to stable housing, that their outcomes would be better, that families could stay together in more productive ways. And so I think this is a real opportunity for us at the agency head level, but also in the policymaking arena, to be very thoughtful and targeted about how we leverage this resource and make sure that the right families are served when we build these new apartments, and that we do it in a way that those families can be supported to be successful and eventually move out of those apartments and make them available to other families. So I think it's a big opportunity. I know we're going to want to talk more about it as the session proceeds. I think I'll sort of leave it there for now, but if we want to come back to that at some point, I'm happy to do so. A couple of other pieces of legislation. Again, you see the House Bill 2442 is our policy and governance bill. There's House Bill 2441, which would provide an extension and a renewal of the Oregon IDA tax credit. And that's something we're working very closely with our partners on. It's a very successful program that really helps people, low-income people, build assets and move towards economic independence. And then I mentioned Senate Bill 244, which is our program change bill. There's another piece of legislation which is not ours, but it is our friends at the Department of Revenue, and that's Senate Bill 296. Which would transfer responsibility for administration of the Elderly Rental Assistance Program from Department of Revenue to my department. This has been a piece that's been discussed in the legislature for a number of years, that's my understanding. This would complete the transfer. We're working closely with the representatives of the beneficiaries of this rental assistance program and also with Department of Revenue, so that we can give the elderly folks who are used to counting on this resource plenty of notice about how the program could potentially change, and we would give them access to the Community Action Agency resources, because we would imagine this would fold into our other rent assistance programs that they run on our behalf. And we want to give ourselves plenty of time to do that thoughtfully. Okay. So on to policy and essential packages. Package 070 is really eliminating some positions. It's part of the streamlining that I mentioned yesterday, that we are getting smaller, trying to be smart about how many FTE we have to deliver our programs. So we think that's productive. Package 090 restores the one-time increase made in the 14 session to both the emergency housing account and the state homeless assistance programs. The effect of this is that it keeps those accounts at the level that they're at for the 13-15 biennium. Package 101 restores some limited duration positions to continue this Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Program. This is the foreclosure program that we got federal money for. And again, it was 37 staff in the 13-15 budget, and we're reducing it down to 12 positions and 8.5 FTE for the coming biennium. Package 102 restores a limited duration position for the CASA program. And that, again, is connected to the fact that they're in our agency, and when that change was made, the staff that was assigned was as a limited duration position. So we need to re-up that, if you will. 104, as we've discussed, would transfer programs to DHS, the food programs. Continue at a more limited level than we've had historically the funds to provide foreclosure counseling through counseling centers. We had received, starting back in 2012 in response to the foreclosure crisis, $3 million and then another $4.9 million for this biennium to implement counseling and legal assistance in connection with the mediation program. And so the governor's budget this time would propose to effectively phase that out and provide $1 million of funding in the new biennium. I believe you'll be hearing from our partners about that a little bit later today. 106 would provide more program funding for the Oregon Volunteers Program. And it would also set aside some funds to do effectively a transition plan to consider possibilities for moving Oregon Volunteers out from underneath our agency to be something that is more independent and self-sufficient. We had been trying to think about ways to do this, and so what the governor's budget proposed is that we buy ourselves this next biennium to come up with a thoughtful transition plan, and I'm committed to Oregon Volunteers and their board to do it in a thoughtful way and provide support to them to the best of my ability. And so we will be working on that in the coming months with the idea that we would come back in February with some recommendations. 110 again is the family affordable housing package. We've discussed that. I probably will dispense with speaking more about that at this moment, although happy to answer questions. And then, as requested, reporting to you on position vacancies for the agency. You've heard me talk about sort of downsizing the agency. We do still have a number of vacancies, some of which have been filled since this report date. A couple of them I want to just hold and pending sort of some more analysis of what do we really need operationally. There's been a lot of change at the agency. But we're fully sort of transparent about how we're managing those with DAS and the 4131 process. Really no questions, huh? We need to report to you on the 10% reduction options, and so you'll see in the next couple of slides what a 10% reduction would do in the various program areas, starting with those programs that are general fund. And you can see, you know, that we do serve a lot of vulnerable Oregonians, and certainly cuts in these programs at the 10% scale would be lessen our impact pretty considerably. And the next suite of programs is here as well. And we've distinguished between general fund, lottery fund, and other funds and federal funds in these exercises. I'm going to keep moving unless you want to pause on any of those. Okay. Okay. And then other fund ending balances. There's a more detailed spreadsheet in the appendix to our report to you. I've highlighted some of the more significant balances for you here. In the safety net programs or the kind of homelessness assistance programs, we're projecting rather modest balances, and those are just cash flow timing questions that are connected to those projections. We do have some large numbers projected in the ECHO program, which is energy conservation helping Oregonians. This was a large balance last biennium as well. We have continued to work very closely with the community action agencies who administer these programs on our behalf. What I'm told about the $9.6 million balance is that the bulk of that has already been allocated to the CAF agencies, and that they have long pipelines of projects in the queue. There is a timing problem connected to getting these, when the money comes in the door and what it takes to spend it with projects out in the field. And so that's a piece I think we can continue to work on with the CAP agencies to make sure that they can fully deploy these resources. And if they need some assistance with that, I'm committed to helping them do that so that we're not sitting on large balances. Some large numbers in this on these next couple of slides as well. These are in the multifamily rental housing program area. Again, the timing questions here continue to be a thing I want to pay attention to, but effectively we do accumulate cash both from the public purpose charge and from the document recording fee. We offer those funds for multifamily development and preservation. They are reserved, and then it takes some time for the projects that are being developed to move their way through the pipeline. And so we end up, because of those timing issues, with pretty large balances. In the 3 years I've been at the agency, I can tell you that we've swung from sort of over-committing and getting a little ahead of ourselves and having to manage cash a little bit more carefully once it's time to actually fund a project. And we've swung back a little bit the other way. And so what I'm working on with my relatively new executive team is to really calibrate that right. Of course, we need to have funds reserved, and we need to be sure that they're available when the project sponsors need them. But we don't want to find ourselves in a position where we're accumulating large cash balances that could be better spent. So those numbers are large. I'm told they've been large for many years. And so I don't think from that perspective it's too startling. On the other hand, I want you to hear me say I'm committed to being as smart as possible about cash flow management on these. Okay. And the general housing account there, the second one on the list is the document recording fee, and we're working with our partners to get that allocated. And then a couple of smaller accounts related to mobile home parks and the homeownership assistance. And these are small amounts as well. So again, more detail, including some notes in your in the appendix. All right, look.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Bembley. Well done. And I know you had some answers to some of the questions that were asked yesterday, so why don't we begin with pending questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we were able to find quickly some answers to a few of the questions. We're going to need to follow up on a couple of them, and a couple of my partners who are here to speak to you in public testimony will probably have some insights on a couple of them as well. So one of the questions was, what is the outstanding bond debt? The answer to that, as of the last audit, which was June 30th of 14, $1.16 billion in outstanding indebtedness in both single-family and multifamily bond indentures. And a question came also about, well, how do reserves work on that? So we did some quick analysis. It's about $78 million in reserves against that $1.16 billion. That is fairly well prescribed by the rating agencies as the level required to retain those ratings. So they're quite large numbers that are a result of work over a number of years. And I think, there was also a question about the kind of profile of people in various parts of the housing system. This is a question about how many are elderly and disabled versus family. And so we were able to pull from the public housing authorities, which operate independently from us. There's a housing authority that covers every jurisdiction in the state. Housing authorities traditionally and currently serve the poorest of the poor. What data we have on the 28,000 households that are served by those local public housing authorities is that half of them, 50%, are households with a person with a disability, and 23% of them are elderly. Now, there's some duplication within that, 23 and 50, but clearly half or better of the folks are elderly or disabled. And the average income of those households is just shy of $12,000 a year. So very poor individuals and families served by public housing. One of the major portfolios that we have is financed with tax credits, federal low-income housing tax credits. We did a survey, a tenant survey recently, and had about 3,800 tenants living in those buildings respond to that survey. Of those, just 21% had an elderly head of household, and 7% had a disabled head of household. So it's a different profile served by apartments that are financed with tax credits than apartments managed by housing authorities. The average income in that portfolio is about $20,000 a year.
Question, Representative Whitson?
Yes, I was wondering, so that's 28,000 in one program and 3,800 in another. How many do you serve total in all the housing programs that you oversee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, I apologize. I don't actually have that number at hand. I do want to clarify, the 28,000 are not, they're not part of our portfolio. These are public housing authorities operating independently and getting their funds directly from HUD. So the total portfolio, let me add that to the questions that I get back to you in writing on. I should know it, and it's a little embarrassing that I don't. But the 3,800 was a survey responses.
Okay, so I have a follow-up. So in the 64 agencies that contribute to the 49 programs that you oversee for housing, HUD is outside of those? Outside
That's
of
correct.
That?
Okay.
Is there anything else besides HUD that's outside of that then?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, yes, and a couple things come to mind that I'd be happy to brief you on sort of outside this meeting if that's useful. Of course, I'd be happy to come back. There was actually an audit done by the Secretary of State's office a couple of years ago now that looked at all the places in state government where there's housing of some variety provided, looking for a duplication and overlap. And so let me pull that out and share that with you as a look at sort of the housing system. It is diffuse and complicated, and we control part of it, but certainly not all of it.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. VanVleet. Are there other questions for the director? Yes, Senator Monroe.
What's the definition of elderly?
Mr. Chair and
Senator. Very sensitive about this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Monroe, so as am I. It depends. Some programs, the cutoff is 55, others it's 62. It depends on the color of money. And so if you'd like follow up on that, I can certainly get you more on that.
I passed those numbers a long time ago.
I was going to say, you
point well taken.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair. On your policy option number 070, you have, 102. On 102, you're adding one FTE for over $250,000. Can you explain that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, so that's a two-year figure. And it includes salary and benefits.
How much does that person get paid, do you know?
Mr. Chair, let's see. It's S, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman. It's 180 in personal services. Does that mean that's the payroll?
Correct.
That's payroll and benefits is 180. So the balance above 180 is services and supplies.
So the 180 is a biennial figure. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
One more question, Representative.
So, and thanks again, Ms. VanVleet, for the presentation. That was a long slog there. So. on the $100 million for affordable housing, mm-hmm. and I guess this is kind of a social policy question. When you build the affordable housing in multifamily units there, Are all of the units dedicated to low-income housing? And then the more pertinent question is, if that's the case, is that wise? And that's this kind of social policy question.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, it's a very good question, and I think it probably needs to look different in different communities. If we're going to do 10 or 20 or 50, even 50 units in a relatively small community, you could have 100% of it be affordable, but you could still have graduated income levels. So you could have some set aside for families or individuals who are really poor, less than 30% of median income, all the way up to 60. And I think those are trade-offs we need to think about and how much leverage we want to get out of the $100 million. So the lower the rents, as you know, the less there is for debt service and the bigger the need is for capital or equity into an individual piece of real estate. So there's trade-offs I think we're going to need to make. There certainly are good policy arguments for mixed income communities if you get to apartment communities of scale. And so we haven't done a lot of that in this state, but there are places where we know mixing of incomes and having some that are not rent restricted or not income restricted balances from both a social policy but also financially inside of a transaction. So I think we want to look at both, and we don't have we could model 100 different scenarios, and I think those are conversations we're going to want to have.
Can I follow?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do you have any legal impediments to doing any kind of mixed income thing or even free income things where you say X percent of the units are just rented out on the free market? Or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, we're not sure about the legal requirements and sort of the sideboards just yet. We've got lawyers, a team of lawyers answering a set of questions for us that get along those lines. To some degree, it's going to depend if you're trying to also use other colors of money, because a dollar that comes from the federal tax credit program or from some of the other programs you've heard me talk about the last couple of days will sort of taint the whole project. Others won't. And so I think we have to be savvy about it. My vision is we might be able to do, if you did a 50-unit building in a community like Bend or Redmond, for example, you might be able to say, well, 20 of them will be for very low-income families, and that's where this money will go. And if you can carve that off and say the other 30 units are market rate, maybe that's a model that can help us leverage. So I think those are all possible, but we want to do it within the constraints of Article 11Q for sure.
One more.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your indulgence on that. So $100 million, and from talking to you the other day, that I think you intend to spread that over 5 years because you just can't put $100 into the pipeline that quickly. We're nearing the end of this recession, or I hope, knock on wood, we're ending nearing the end of this recession. Is this too late? Is the demand going to be there at the end of the 5 years that you get this started? Did we start this 5 years too late? Or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, I don't think so. All the trends that we can see are that real estate prices are continuing to escalate much faster than wages. And what we know is for many years, even when we were not in a recession, there was a demand that outstripped supply. I'm very personally very confident. I've done this work for 25 years, and I think our partners are very confident that given the added resource, we can execute, we can absolutely find eligible families to be housed in new apartments that would look like this. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
All right. Thank you very much. If there's no other questions, I'm going to give Ms. Van Vliet a chance to catch her breath. And Ms. Brickman.
So do you want to? We've got to switch. We just need to have the.
Do you want this?
That keyboard would be fine. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tamara Brickman with the Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office. And while you've heard probably pretty much everything I'm going to say from Margaret, I'm just going to do a very high-level overview of the governor's budget process and putting together the governor's budget for the agency. And, of course, one of the emerging issues that was important to deal with, which is part of what the director talked about, is implementation of a new model of state governance for the agency, and then also, which was not placed on here and I neglected to put the bullet, was also considerations for prosperity for Oregonians, and so that's part of how the budget for the department was built. The department's programs all align within the 10-year outcome plan in the Healthy People outcome area, which strives to ensure that Oregonians enjoy good health and the best quality of life. And with respect to this particular budget, the agency budget has a significant investment within its packages for affordable housing. This just provides you a quick overview of the department's expenditure history. You can see from the left to the right is the 2011 and 13 actuals by fund type down below. Sorry, it's kind of hard to see. But generally what, and then you have the legislatively approved budget in the middle and the governor's budget on the far right. And what this is basically showing you is that the department receives a very small amount of general and lottery funds. The lottery fund is all dedicated for debt service on lottery bonds that have been sold for affordable housing projects already. The majority of their funding comes from other funds and you know, not limited and non-limited source. And the expenditures for the department, as you can see, are largely, if you want to call them so-called administrative expenses, the employee costs and the services and supplies, that equates to about 3% of the agency's budget. The capital housing is the actual where we had to technically place the $85 million for the Article 11Q obligation bonds. So that would actually be part of the payments to individuals and others, which you can see represents about 41% of the agency's budget. And then the agency budget for 2015-17, 50% of it is dedicated to debt service for previously obligated bonds. And that would be include lottery bonds, but very small amount, like $11 million, and the rest is all revenue bonds from the agency. The investments that were important for the governor in putting into this budget were the affordable housing, the $100 million in affordable housing bonds, $15 million of lottery-backed bonds, and $85 million of Article 11 Q-backed bonds. Was also the funding for the emergency housing assistance and state homelessness assistance programs was held to the legislatively approved level for the current biennium, which is $2 million additional general fund for this biennium. We also maintained the court-appointed special advocate's position, which would have, because it was limited duration in nature, would have gone away at the end of this biennium. So we restored it so that there would still be a position to administer the CASA program within the agency. And then a small investment in continuing the mortgage foreclosure assistance program, the counseling that the department provides funding to the community agencies for that. And then we did enhance funding for the Oregon Commission on Voluntary Service by $250,000 general fund, and $125,000 of that was set aside in a special purpose appropriation in order to set to incent and bring parties together to develop a plan as to whether or not this commission should be spun off as an independent or maybe placed someplace else where it would better operate. And so that in a nutshell, was the governor's budget. Comparison to the co-chair's framework, just the governor's budget provides $15.7 million general fund to housing and community services. And just with respect to specifics, in the framework, there's not a specific number that has been mentioned for the department. And also, the co-chair's budget doesn't, it defers decisions on the bonding, which would include the $15 million and the $85 million for affordable housing. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I know you have people that are eagerly waiting to testify.
We do indeed. So I thank you, Ms. Brickman. And we do appreciate that thorough presentation from both of you. I'm going to go ahead and turn to the public portion of the testament. Senator, you look like you had a question.
No, I'm sorry.
Thanks. All right. We have 9 people signed up to testify. We have about 45 minutes remaining, so I'm not going to put a timer up here, but I would encourage you to keep your remarks concise if you would. And I'm going to bring people up. No, I don't need a timer. these are good people, and if they talk too long, we're going to ask them a lot of difficult questions. So why don't we bring people up in groups, and I'm going to bring 3 to the table at a time, and I'm going to start with the visitors here from CASA, and that would be Mr. Johnson, Ms. Henderson, and Mr. Lee. If you'd like to come up, and you can take that in whatever order you'd like to go. Our procedures are that we'd ask you to introduce yourself for the record at the beginning of your presentation, and welcome to our committee today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee. My name is Sid Johnson from Eugene, Oregon. I'm a member of the board of Lane County CASA and a former CASA myself. I've been involved in CASA for 6 years. And I have seen firsthand what a CASA volunteer does for a child's life. My career has focused in children's policy at the state and national level, as a legislative assistant to Michigan Governor George Romney, as a senior policy aide to Senator and Vice President Walter Mondale, and as the CEO of a number of nonprofits concerned with child welfare. I appear today to urge you to approve the $869,000 appropriation increase for CASA in the governor's budget. This would provide $695,000 to restore, taking inflation into account, the CASA funding level of 8 years ago, and $175,000 in new funding, which would be the first increase in CASA funding since 2007. Research shows that abused and neglected children with a CASA volunteer compared to those without a CASA volunteer are less likely to be re-abused, less likely to re-enter the costly foster care system, and more likely to be placed in safe and permanent homes. In 2013, 1,828 CASAs statewide serve 4,820 abused and neglected children. However, 60% of the Oregon children who need a CASA don't have one, even though Oregon statute mandates that every child who needs one should have a CASA. Our requested funding increase would provide CASA volunteers to an additional 407 to 630 abused children in the next biennium, reducing from 60% to 50% the children who need a CASA but don't have one. Importantly, your state appropriations for CASA leverage private funding. In 2013, the state appropriated $1 million. $4 million was raised by CASA from private funding. And the increase we seek from the state appropriation now would leverage more private funding in the next 2 years. Additionally, to ensure proper management of CASA funds, we asked, as the department did, that the one-person FTE to administer CASA be continued. One final point, as you know better than I, the upcoming economic forecast may make the kicker into effect. And if so, we would ask that you keep our full appropriation increase regardless in the budget for three reasons. Research shows how much CASA helps children. Taking into account inflation, CASA's state appropriation has been cut 37% in the last 8 years. And while this $870,000 increase would mean enormous benefits to children, it represents only 0.0046 of the co-chair's huge budget. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson. Thanks for being here. We'll hold questions till we're finished with this panel. Ms. Henderson, we apologize in advance for taking you away from the beach today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you to Co-Chair Gomberg, my representative, and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Henderson. I am the Executive Director of CASA of Lincoln County and Tillamook County. However, today I'm here also in my role as an advocate, as a CASA volunteer. And I'll repeat to you what one of my colleagues stated, excuse me, at a presentation I heard when I first started as a CASA director and as an advocate. And she said to the group, "Congratulations, you are the proud parents of over 11,000 children. And with all due respect, the state does not make a good parent." Advocates work hard so that children in state care actually spend a shorter amount of time in care and cost the taxpayers less money. A volunteer investigates, advocates, facilitates, and monitors the cases of abused, neglected, and drug-affected children in state foster care. When I began as executive director in 2007, I decided to take on a case of a child coming into foster care because I wanted to know exactly what I was asking my volunteers to do when I recruited and trained them and placed them with a child in foster care. Unfortunately, the child I became an advocate to in 2007, when she was 4 years old, I am still her advocate. She is still in state care after 8 years. Nearly 8 years. She's had 11 caseworkers. She's had two attorneys, gone before three judges, been in 23 placements, and I am proud to say that I've been her one advocate in all of this time. So she knows throughout all these other people she has to talk to and visit with and that sort of thing, she knows my face, she knows my name, she understands who I am and that I'm there for her to go and speak to the judge for her. Fortunately, most of our cases don't last that long. We do work in cooperation with DHS Child Welfare, the legal system, and the court system. The difference in having an advocate, these children all have caseworkers from child welfare. A caseworker, at least in the county I come from, each caseworker has a caseload of approximately 30 to 35 children at any given time. Our advocates are able to spend time one-on-one really looking into and investigating for each child. Something many people, I think, don't realize is that we as advocates become legal parties to the case and report to the judge on a regular basis what is in the best interest of children. Our advocates are trained in a highly intensive training that lasts 20 hours, plus we send homework home, and we also require an additional 30 hours of courtroom observation in juvenile dependency cases. Let me just tell you one very quick story where an advocate has made a life and death difference in the life of a child. A DHS supervisor in Lincoln County stated last year that this particular advocate literally saved the life of a young boy in care. He had been moved amongst three foster homes in a fairly short amount of time. In that time, he'd had his medication changed. So he was being over-medicated, and really no one realized that, and no one noticed that except his advocate, who was on top of his medication and how he was acting and that sort of thing. She was able to report that to who needed to look into it, and so fortunately today that child is fine. There are many more stories like that one, and I support CASA appropriations increase because I know what we do, I know what our advocates can do for children who aren't able to speak for themselves. Thank you so much, and I'm happy to answer any questions when we're finished with Travis.
Thank you so much, Ms. Henderson. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lee, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gumbert and subcommittee members. I'm Travis Lee. I'm from Lincoln County, and I live in Newburgh now. I've been in foster care for almost my whole life, and this April I'll be aging out of care. And I've lived in, last 5 years, I've lived in 17 different foster homes and moved more times than I can count. I've had more caseworkers than I could count on, like, from months. My CASA caseworker was assigned to me when I was in fifth grade and has been my same CASA worker since then. And that's something that really is really important to me, because not knowing when you get a new caseworker, caseworkers, I feel like, change on a monthly basis. And knowing that I always have someone there that's there since I was in fifth grade to I've been out of high school is something that's really important to me. The first time I ever met my CASA, he talked to me and told me that he was going to get me and my brother back together, or make sure that we got to have more communications and got to see each other, which is really important. I grew up with my brother, and then in fourth grade, me and my brother got separated, and we didn't talk for a year and a half. And because of my CASA, I got to communicating with my brother again and seeing my brother, which was important because he's family, the only family I really have. My CASA also connected me with sports, because I told him I love sports and wanted to play sports, but a lot of my foster parents didn't allow me to play sports. And so my CASA brought that up to the judge, and my judge pretty much told my foster parents to let me play sports. And without sports, I would not be where I'm today. I would have not graduated high school with a regular diploma instead of a modified. My coaches and team always pushed me and helped me get good grades. I graduated with a 2.75. And now I'm going to be going to college in fall for my basic EMT and paramedic license to become a full-time paid firefighter. Thank you for the opportunity for testifying, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you so much for your story, and congratulations on your success. Have you testified like this before?
I have not.
Well, you know, if what we've heard today is any indication, I wouldn't be surprised if someday you'll be sitting up here.
Thank you.
Are there questions for this panel?
I wouldn't wish that on him.
Any questions? Thank you all so very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, I wanted to invite Mr. Pixley, Ms. Heb, and Ms. Boyd.
Bird.
That looks like an O. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may we play with the order a little bit?
I'm sorry?
May we play with the order a little bit?
Any way you'd like to go.
Please do.
No, you go first.
Okay. Whichever you like.
We're at your disposal. How would you like to go?
Well, I'd like to have the young man come back and speak for me, please. But, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stephen Pixley. I'm the volunteer program committee. I'm the volunteer program coordinator for the City of Portland's Parks and Recreation Department. I'm also a volunteer, and that's why I'm here today. I serve as the vice chair of the Oregon Volunteer Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. As a statutory home for the federal AmeriCorps funding in our state, Oregon Volunteers celebrated its 20th anniversary in 2014. Our small staff and program volunteers work hard every day to achieve our mission. That is strengthening our communities by inspiring Oregonians to actively engage and volunteer and serve. As you'll see from the information included in your handout, our programs create a big impact in every corner of the state and a wide variety of focus areas. That's that right there. Thank you. They're all targeted at meeting some of the state's most pressing needs. We do this through our four programming areas: AmeriCorps, volunteerism, civic engagement, and the court-appointed special advocates, or CASA. I'm here today to ask your support for $3.5 million general funding for appropriation for Oregon volunteers included in the governor's proposed budget. $3.25 million of those funds are earmarked for the CASA program, and I cannot overemphasize how important CASA is to the children of our state. Since gaining statutory responsibility for administering CASA funds in 2012, we've worked hard to build trust and to help local CASA programs transition from funding relationships they had with their county commissions on children and families to a centralized system administered at the state's level. With our colleagues at the Oregon CASA Network, we're working diligently to help ensure stability of local programs and to build the capacity of networks. As House Bill 4082 Task Force recognized last fall, CASA is a good fit under our strategic volunteerism goal. That is to help organizations, to make sure your organizations are capable of providing positive volunteer experiences and people are able to find meaningful, appropriate volunteer opportunities. Our CASA efforts would not be possible without the one full-time employee and administrative funds included in this budget. Our small staff would not have the bandwidth to oversee the program otherwise. We also want to speak in support of the additional $900,000 included in the governor's budget for local CASA programs. As you've heard, this will be the first increase in state funding for the program since 2007. And as our CASA colleagues will tell you, the need is great. The remaining $250,000 in the budget is general fund intended to stabilize Oregon volunteers. Many of you may not be aware that the state commission lost at least 62% of federal funds in late 2011. Since then, we've worked diligently to keep our programs alive and thriving. We've succeeded in spite of 50% cut in staffing, but our ability to maintain is at risk. This small investment by the state will enable us to continue our current services and to leverage $30.8 million from non-state funding sources, volunteerism, and national service in the next biennium. These funds, combined with the budget note requiring us to report back to the legislature next year about the most appropriate administrative structure for our continued success, are welcome and needed. We look forward to working together with you and other members of the legislature to realize our vision for Oregon, which is to ensure that volunteering is an integral, prominent, and essential part of everyday life. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pixley. Again, we'll hold questions till the end of the panel. Who's going to go next?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Park.
Partnerships. I'm here today on behalf of the Housing Alliance, which is a coalition that we convene. It's a coalition of advocacy organizations, local jurisdictions, people concerned with housing opportunities across the state. And I have uploaded a number of things to OLIS that I'll just sort of call your attention to, and then I just want to highlight a couple points today. On OLIS, we have our legislative agenda as well as some need sheets by county that just sort of document the range of housing needs. You can look at the counties that you represent. What we see from that, from the survey, and then you'll hear some stories today, is that housing needs across the state are remarkable. We see just an explosion in need from folks experiencing homelessness, living on the streets, to people not being able to access rental housing. And you've heard some of this from Director Van Vliet. One of the numbers that you discussed yesterday was the number of homeless school children, getting close to 20,000 homeless school children a year. That's school-age children. We know that families with younger children are actually much more vulnerable to homelessness. And that's one of the needs that we want to talk with you about today. We are very much in support of the Housing and Community Services budget that you heard about and the proposal for $100 million in new units. We see that as a step towards addressing the long-term housing needs of our communities. We have some really urgent short-term needs that we want to call to your attention as well, and that's what we want to focus on. One of those will go to capital construction. It's looking at preserving existing rent-subsidized housing. It's important that we not lose ground and go backwards. Two, I'm going to talk to you about with my partner. So you'll hear a little bit later about foreclosure assistance. And I want to talk about emergency housing assistance and state homeless assistance programs. Those resources have essentially been flat since about 2007. We heard of a small bump to those resources in the last biennium. The Housing Alliance is asking that those two funds together, Emergency Housing Account and State Homeless Assistance Program, get $20 million in resources in the coming year. That would represent an $8 million increase in this biennium. What we hear from our partners is that we have kind of a perfect storm that is creating problems throughout our communities. We have rents that are much higher than usual. We're seeing some communities 10% increases in rents. We see vacancy rates at their lowest ever. Their vacancy rates in Bend are reported to be below 1%, which is pretty much unheard of. What happens then is that we have a backlog of people can't access shelter, people who are in shelter can't get out into permanent housing. If there is housing for folks to go into, it's costing more to place folks into housing. So we're seeing this real short-term crisis. We heard the economic forecast talk about how we're halfway there, and essentially what they meant is that half of us are doing okay, and the rest of us aren't quite making it through the recovery now. So we really see a need for short-term investments, significant investments, to help us meet the dire needs that our communities are facing. I'm joined today by Jane Downing, who's going to talk to you a little bit about the need for homeless resources.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director for the Center for Hope and Safety. And we provide services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking in Marion County. We provide a safe shelter, 24-hour crisis line, and other supportive services to victims and survivors in our community. I am hoping so much that you will support the EHA and SHAP funding that is going to go to shelters and to other programs that help with housing. What I can tell you in doing this work for 24 years, we have never seen a time when folks are staying longer in shelter. Our numbers have actually doubled in the amount of time that folks are needing to stay with us because there's not other resources available to them. In addition, even the ones who are lucky enough to get a housing voucher are having a huge difficulty being able to find and access that housing. And so you have individuals who are ready to move on, to move from that crisis towards self-sufficiency, and to have to tell them, I'm sorry, there's not any housing available, is so incredibly difficult for us. Or we're struggling for them to be able to pay those rents and keep it up. And so this kind of housing is absolutely critical. And to have it be community-based, where they're making those decisions on the best place for that housing and that supportive services for shelter to be, is absolutely critical to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault in across the state. And we hear over and over from all the programs and all the survivors that housing is one of the most important needs that they are struggling to fill. And so I really encourage your support for EHA and CHAP funding. It can make a huge difference for your constituents in your community. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you about this.
No, thank you, and thank you for your good work. Any questions for this group? All right, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, we have our final three, and that would be Ms. Sachs, Mr. Wong, and again, Sybil. Thank you for your patience. Any order that you'd like.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, of the subcommittee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm with the Oregon Law Center here today to testify in support of the entire Housing and Community Services budget and all of the housing supports and structures for our communities across the state. I particularly wanted to talk with you about foreclosure and the Foreclosure Avoidance Program, which was in Package 105 of the budget. As you know, our offices provide services to low-income Oregonians throughout the state. There was a time when I first started doing this work when we didn't do foreclosure because our clients who were low-income weren't people who also owned homes. That's no longer the case. When the crisis hit this state, suddenly there were many people who were homeowners, who were low-income, who suddenly had no resources left, who were struggling because of foreclosure, and the complex issues that arise out of that in terms of navigating modification requests and trying to navigate the complex legal process of the foreclosure proceeding. And so we were getting requests for help, and that's changed the nature of the practice that we engage in. And we're very, very grateful to the work of this committee and the legislature as a whole and to our partners and allies in passing some significant protections and resources for struggling homeowners in the past number of years. And so the mediation program that was put into place in 2012 and then modified slightly in 2013 has made a big difference to our clients and their ability to sit down and navigate the process of foreclosure and hopefully to come out the other side either with a home retention option or at least with a resolution that they understand and that they feel was fair. And so we're very grateful for that. That program, that mediation program, doesn't work without the assistance of housing counselors who are funded to work across the state and to provide hands-on assistance to homeowners struggling to figure out what their paperwork means, how to get it organized, and then how to enter the mediation program. And it also, the mediation program relies upon the assistance of attorneys where necessary when there are complex legal issues that need to get resolved before the case can move forward. And so I'll defer to Ms. Sachs here next to me to talk about the housing counseling piece, but I'll tell you a little bit about the legal assistance piece, which has been funded over the past couple of years. We have five attorneys who are funded to provide services on a statewide basis. We have a hotline that is staffed by bilingual intake specialists who helps us determine which cases are eligible for representation. The people that we can't help, we have tried to refer to, because of demand issues, we've tried to refer to a pro bono network of attorneys, private attorneys who have volunteered to work with us and help folks who were not able to help and just really increase our capacity. We're very grateful to their work. And this program that is funded through the Housing and Community Services Agency has allowed us us to provide training and organization for those pro bono attorneys to help them get connected to folks who are in need of assistance. I know that there are signs of recovery in our economies. We're very grateful for that, and we're encouraged by that. I want to make sure that we're also aware, though, that there are some significantly troubling statistics around the continued problem that foreclosure is causing. The FDIC, I just read yesterday, reports that there are still enormous backlogs of delinquent loans, and nearly $58 billion in residential loans are currently in the midst of foreclosure in our nation, and that apparently represents only 48% of delinquent loans. So there's a backlog, then, that is still delinquent that has not yet entered the system. And we're seeing locally foreclosure rates, and my testimony on OLIS will reflect this graph, that there are 20,000 Oregonians that are currently 90 days or more delinquent, and that's four times the rate of what was previously the rate prior to the crisis. So we're still at elevated rates. We're still very grateful for the mediation program and for the resources that we're able to provide as a result of your work, and it's still really important to our communities. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Sachs, welcome.
Hello, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your support and for letting me speak with you today about the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program. My name is Karen Sachs, and I supervise the Foreclosure Intervention Counseling and Education Services at NEDCO's Springfield office. NEDCO's service area spans all of Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties. As you may know, homeowners are required by statute to meet with a foreclosure counselor before they attend a mediation session in the OFA program. Since the program began, over 2,200 homeowners have participated, and close to 70% of the concluded cases have reached an agreement in order to help solve the mortgage crisis. All participants in the OFA program, including lenders, lenders' attorneys, facilitators, and homeowners, agree that the presence of a housing counselor is crucial to successful outcomes. Like Sybil said, there have been recent news stories about signs of economic and housing recovery, but we really, unfortunately, know that that's just not the reality facing many Oregonians. Mortgage delinquency rates are still four times as high as before the recession in Oregon, and agencies across the state are seeing steady demand for counseling. Lender filings into the OFA program remain consistently high, and we have yet to see a dip in those filings. Honestly, because we're as anxious as I'm sure probably all of you are as to when the foreclosure crisis really will end, we watch these numbers on a monthly basis. In conjunction with OHCS, a mediation case manager, and the Department of Justice, we monitor a variety of data points in order to help us determine the need and demand for this program. And we are also confident this will help us anticipate when the program can start to wind down. But really, we're just not there yet. And what we really want to make sure in the meantime is that every Oregonian who needs it has access to a foreclosure counselor and to the OFA program. The current demand for housing will utilize all the available funds before the end of this biennium. And so we've worked closely with OHCS and with advocates to map out demand and would support the request for an additional $349,000 for this biennium. And as we look to the next biennium, we see the evidence suggesting the continued demand for the OFA program. And we would fully support the request from the Housing Alliance and from Legal Aid for the 15-17 biennium of $5 million to ensure continued counseling and legal assistance for Oregon homeowners. In closing, I'd like to leave you with the words of a homeowner who went through the OFA program and with the assistance of the counselor. He said, "It's very intimidating to be in a room with an attorney for your lender, one who's, you know, well-versed and has a specific agenda, as well as a neutral mediator. Without the support of NEDCO and the housing counselor, I would likely have lost my home and been unable to provide decent housing for my four children. So I thank you again for your continued support of foreclosure counseling and for Oregon homeowners, and I'd be happy to answer any questions."
Thank you very much. Mr. Wong.
Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong of Oregon Food Bank. I'm here to talk about the role that Oregon Food Bank Network plays in the state of Oregon with respect to the housing and community services budget. As you know, the food programs and the housing community services budget are in the process of transitioning to the Department of Human Services, but I thought I'd take the time, as I understood from yesterday, there were some questions about how the Oregon Food Bank Network works, how it relates to the Oregon Hunger Response Fund and the other programs that Margaret Van Vliet had mentioned. But before I do that, I do want to extend our gratitude to Director Van Vliet and her staff for working with us very, very closely from the very start of the conversation of transitioning these programs She bent over backwards. We had a lot of meetings. We had a lot of, frank discussions about what was the best way to serve hungry Oregonians. And so we've landed in a spot. There's still a lot of work to be done as far as what that looks like as it moves the Department of Human Services, but I do want to make sure that we thank Margaret again for her her openness to work with us. So to begin, I did pass out some materials for you. I know some of you are new to the committee, although some of you may have stepped out, but you'll have the opportunity to review it. So I'm going to start with the Oregon Hunger Response Fund and how it relates to the Oregon Food Bank Network. I'll try to be very quick and brief and then leave time for questions. So the Oregon Hunger Response Fund is a fund that's through the general funds. It's a $2.7 million biennium request that was budgeted for the current biennium, and it's also budgeted at the same level in the governor's budget. And before I, talk about about the details, we are requesting a $3.2 million request for the next biennium. So if there's any opportunity for the subcommittee to provide any recommendations as this moves to the Subcommittee on Human Services, we would greatly appreciate that. So that $2.73 million that is funded is actually used in two primary ways. It's used first in acquiring food, usually from the food industry, and repacking food. So that requires resources such as food grade material, so on and so forth, and some good old fashioned volunteers like Representative Gomberg, who came out not too long ago. But it takes folks to coordinate those volunteers and take staffing. So that leads to the second part of how the fund is used. And that fund is also used to build capacity for regional food banks. And in the state of Oregon, this fund is actually more critical to the rural regional food banks because they tend to be a lot smaller and they don't have as easy access to some of the resources that the urbanized regional food banks have. So just think volunteers and just think, the size of their refrigerators, being able to take certain bulk donations, so on and so forth. So they rely on these funds essentially to maintain their capacity and hopefully to be able to provide more food to families that rely on it. And through the food bank network, i.e. all 20 regional food banks, you'll see in this chart, you'll have a sense, it's about a $22 million a year operation if you combine all if you combine all the regional food banks, which actually also includes Clark County because they operate in coordination with us, but they don't receive Oregon funds. I want to be clear with that, but we do work with them very, very closely. So the amount that the Hunger Response Fund contributes to it, as you can tell, is a small fraction, but nonetheless, it's still very, very important. So having said all of that, the last fiscal year, we're talking 13-14, the Food Bank Network distributed roughly 87.9 million pounds of food, which is the equivalent of roughly 1,135,000 food boxes. And that number's been high. It's been high since the Great Recession. It's been high for the last 4 years. So we are staying high, even though the economy has improved, but it kind of gives you a sense of the types of jobs that are being created and what wages that they are paying. You will also see there's 963 local agencies across the state that are accessing food through the regional food bank system. And so chances are, if there's a social service, church, food pantry in your legislative district, they're probably getting food through the Oregon Food Bank Network. So some of you asked yesterday what's in an emergency food box. And before I go there, I do want to emphasize, too, that the food that we provide isn't just for food boxes. We do provide food for meal sites. So you'll see in this little guide to our regional food banks that there are what are called meal sites. So let me turn to this. Someone did ask about, what's an emergency food box, how much does it weigh, and so let me take a moment to show you this. It's a one-pager that looks like this, and it's really just as a guideline that we give to all of our pantries when we send food out across the state. And as you can tell, it's actually based on the size of the household. So, you know, the pound can range, you know, in a wide variety of ways. The way that I like to look at it is it's about $50 to $100 worth of food a month that a family could access. So essentially, you know, most food pantries, you can only go there once a month. So this food box represents a bill, a utility, or an expense that that family could pay. Obviously, we can't provide food for, you know, their needs every single day. A food box will last you roughly 3 to 5 days. So that's concludes my presentation. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wong. And I'll say that that afternoon I spent with you making big bags of oats into small bags of oats was really a very satisfying afternoon, and particularly knowing what kind of difference it was going to make. Any questions for this panel? Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll ask at this point, is there anybody else here that did not sign up that would like to testify today?
Mr. Chair, while you're waiting for the spirit of testimony to move on people, I would just like to apologize. I thought I was going to be offering brief testimony on a bill an hour later, so with apologies to the agency and my colleagues.
No, we appreciate you being here, Senator. Ms. Van Vliet has offered to repeat her 38 slides for you after we conclude.
That'd be great. Come up to my office.
All right. Well, if there's no further testimony, and I'm not seeing anybody waving their arms, I'm going to go ahead and conclude this public hearing. And tomorrow, committee, we're going to be joined by Mr. Bender, who's going to be talking about the lottery. So we're going to give Ms. Deister a brief reprieve.
That's right. But I will see you again next week.
Anything for the good of the order before we adjourn? Then we are adjourned. Thank you all so much.